My name is Michael McCusker. Perhaps most of you are aware and girding for this weekend, which is Memorial Day weekend, the beginning of the silly season, which will end with the other bookend, Labor Day, in September. Over the years, both of those days, or these days, Memorial and Labor, seem not to matter so much, except, of course, we do have two wars going, and we seem to be in the beginning of a third, possibly. Possibly not, but we are dropping bombs on people. I'd like to read something I've written and revised over time about Memorial Day. I call it Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead. And I should give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire cosmos, in all the parallel universes. Recruiting Tomorrow's Dead. The most shamelessly exploited minority in American society is its war dead. They died horribly, and most of them unwillingly, but they are not left to rot in peace. Their molding, mutilated corpses are eloquently exhumed as spearheads for the next war, their deaths extolled to recruit new armies. A language of lies develops. The dead always died for their country. Heroically and nobly, and all of them willingly made the publicly acclaimed final sacrifice. None raped, pillaged, or burned, or committed other than sanctioned murder or terrorism. None died because of simple bad luck, or from their own stupidity, or that of their commanders, or from callous or asinine battle strategies. None died from accidental shelling or bombing by their own side. All of them were killed facing the enemy, not running away. Their deaths are glorified as justifications for the wars that killed them. Nations are haunted by their war dead. Monuments and memorials are built in every city and somewhere near the center of every town. The war dead assume a purity in death most would have found difficult to attain in life. The official piety is that the cultural lifeblood is sustained by their deaths rather than drained, and only by sacrificing themselves in the same manner will the living gain a similar historical legitimacy. Service to the state is always a possibility to the young, and death in its service is presented as either an ideal or an unavoidable necessity. Families of the dead who should protest the slaughter of their young are instead willing accomplices in the demand that warfare is the only acceptable response to an unruly world. Those who resist that specious reasoning are compared to the heroic dead as unworthy cowards and traitors, implicitly responsible for their deaths. War would end if the dead could return, Stanley Baldwin said. But the irony of war deaths exploited as coercion for others to murder and die is lost in the thunder of voices calling for vengeance and righteous war. War survivors are used as shabbily as the dead. They are contained within government-sponsored veterans organizations that rubber stamp their approval on everything military. They are given parades and empty honors. The horror of their experiences is shielded from public view, gold-plated in boilerplate and pageantry. Yet they are undeniably representatives of humanity's dark side that civilization attempts to disregard or abstract, even while perpetuating it through them. War is blood, carnage, and death, which is so obvious a fact we often ignore it in our preoccupation with the rationales, strategies, weapons, and machines of war. Each generation seems to think it should not be outdone by its predecessors. It must leave its bloody mark on history, no matter how absurd or pointless. Every generation has been incapable or unwilling to arrest the pattern of terror and suffering each inflicts on itself, and our own risks world holocaust because of a compulsive insistence that our time, which is noteworthy only because we live in it, be no less extravagant than the histories we imitate. Albert Schweitzer warned in 1924 that the suicide of civilization was in progress because humanity has lost, quote, the consciousness that every man is an object of concern because he is man, unquote, and predicted that the advance of fully developed inhumanity was only a matter of time. We have talked for decades with ever-increasing light-mindedness about war and conquest, as if these were merely operations on a chessboard, Schweitzer wrote, asking how else that might be possible then, as a result of a tone of mind which no longer pictured to itself the fate of individuals, but thought of them only as figures or objects belonging to the material world. Half a century later, philosopher Donald Wells offered another explanation. The problem of war and conquest and the diminished value of human life was not due to a vague tone of mind, but the demand of government authority over the masses. Wells wrote, "If it is presumed at the outset that the life of the state transcends that of the individual in value, indeed, that the state is more important than all the citizens, then the fact of human death, on even a cosmic scale, will prove irrelevant as an argument against war." And that was Donald Wells. Inhumanity is exclusively human. History seldom mentions compassion or consciousness of every human being as an object of concern, as vital ingredients to the stature of to the structure of civilization. Humanity's history is of wars. The most fierce and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks into each other. It is that way now, when the weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter of millions at each turn of history's gory pages for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost. Only their numbers are marked, aggregates of killers and killed. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or the terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard every other human, and by extension, other cultures, nations, religions, and races, as our blood enemies. We continue to war, or think of war, as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. We refuse to think of ourselves as parts of the same family, or to understand the rarity or privilege of life. Instead, we make war more ardently than love. War gives our lives a transcendent vitality that daily living and its squalid defeats squeeze out of us. We feel that we are a vital part of great events, that our normally diminished lives serve an important purpose at a watershed moment, and we are never so unified, so able to collectively surmount tremendous obstacles as when we make war against each other. We make excuses for warfare and accept it as a consequence of living. We seldom think of war as our invention. We treat it instead as a natural phenomenon, an earthquake, a flood, or volcano. We feed its insatiable thirst for blood with the best blood stock we produce. Until recently, the highest honors a nation or people could bestow were upon the men who draped themselves in the blood of others. life's heroes have always been the men of death. As with most other effects of insatiable technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure nation, are able to make war any time, any place. State-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, credit, or good prospects. Even drug gangs in American ghettos are armed with high-status automatic weapons, as are sociopaths and vengeful boys who spray school playgrounds with bullets. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic weapons and high-tech weapon systems, vicariously enraptured by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Perhaps abstract engagement in war is made possible by outlandish weapons designed in the manner of video games and ardently viewed on video screens and televisions, is verification of the popularity of reality focused through image rather than personal participation. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear obliteration, which has been almost too large a horror to bear for more than nearly three quarters of a century. It seems inconceivable that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, and that by our own will we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Most folks refuse to think we could be so foolish. Yet they suspect our leaders have few qualms or sufficient fears, urged instead to the possibility of the unthinkable by the prospects of opportunity. In such a world, reality hurts. We turn away as we would from a glare of sunlight. We submerge into banality to mute our angst. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of instant creation, it is a prophecy of megadeath. Perhaps we are still in the Garden of Eden, which is a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's reckless ferocity that leads irresistibly toward plucking the ripe fruit of speciesicide. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as accustomed to warfare as breathing and copulating. We are a killing species. We rule Earth because our ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have always butchered our own as readily as any other creature. We kill individually, which is murder, or we organize murder and name it war. We have, throughout history, honored the killers among us, and as we became more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transferred from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest and often decimation of tribes, cities, or nations unlucky to be along the march of more ambitiously militant societies. War has affected civilization tremendously, but its effect upon those who suffer firsthand is given little consideration. Wars determine the reaction and consequent effect upon a society, and recovery is often a long, slow process. Those with personal involvement in a war are not accorded the same respect for their own process of recovery. Their private horrors and nightmares of war are dealt with impatiently and with scorn at possible psychological or physical disabilities, although collectively these sorts of disruptions and discontinuities are accepted as part of the historical process. Looking at history through only the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet wars shape nations and individuals. Much of that which each claims as heritage and honor is bequeathed by war. Waging war is a nation's most serious business. Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate war is so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He had not foreseen its possibilities as video entertainment such as the Persian Gulf War and the air wars over Serbia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. smart missiles and bombs, breaking down doors and falling through factory chimneys. Predator drones that target death from half a world away. High-tech stuff in which the warriors anonymously and indiscriminately, always hotly denied, murder strangers from the stratosphere. Most significant to the human psyche is that a century of air warfare has made the very sky that envelops the Earth the most dangerous threat to existence. The ambiguity of history might be encompassed in a phrase used often by Oliver Cromwell and others. Pray for peace, prepare for war. Earth bristles with preparation. Yet a grim irony of this Brobdingnagian era is that we have reduced human participation in warfare, with the exception of possibly dying in appalling numbers. The invention of the harpoon gun and the exploding harpoon decimated the whale. The chainsaw has cut down the world's forests. By also inventing such weapons as the machine gun and hydrogen bomb, we nearly match our reckless despoilation of the home planet by abetting our own extinction. We have perfected war, refined it to an instrument of digital logic that no longer depends upon human rationale or justification. No philosophy or psychology, only strategy and provocation. Although armies are relatively unnecessary now, they are kept around to engage in traditional fratricide without provoking megadeath. Dead soldiers are Christ-like in a sense. They die as surrogates for the rest of us. Unrestricted warfare in the 20th century also enlarged the soldiers' always shadowy and disavowed parallel role as surrogate executioners. The only real purpose for armies is the destruction of other human beings. Soldiering is big business, the first order of every empire since ancient times. But soldiers are themselves little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. They have been deceived throughout history as to the underlying purposes of the wars they fight, coerced in one manner or another to commit and suffer humanity's most hideous acts, generally in the name of its most sanctified beliefs. And the rewards for such guileless intrepidity are always unequal and usually disproportionate to the fervid sacrifice for them. A people will generally support a war once it is initiated, if for no other reason than they feel there is not much else they can do. That support is considered essential for conducting a war to its end in victory or defeat. In this era of the supposed common person, the focus of support is upon the average soldier, sailor, and airman or woman, who are not responsible for the wars they fight, but make possible. Bellicose war fever is whipped up to discourage questions of a war's purpose or cost, and to disguise the contradiction that supporting a soldier's warlike duty is a sure way of killing or injuring him or her. Instead of the usual honors as heroes, we should pity the hallowed war dead as compliant fools or curse them for being soldiers. It is almost too simple. But without soldiers, there would be no wars. Without soldiers, Caesar would be a scheming minor politician. Napoleon, frustratedly Napoleonic. Hitler, an inferior decorator. Soldiers kill, rape, pillage, burn. And if they are unlucky, stupid, or badly led, they die. If masses of men and women would not immerse themselves into armies and navies, warfare would diminish as a human affliction. All the old deceits and savage antipathies would continue to burn in our flailing breasts, but the scale of havoc would be greatly reduced. John Reed of Oregon saw the sinister side of soldiers and anticipated the civic consequence of military rule. "I hate soldiers," he wrote. "I hate to see a man with a bayonet on his rifle who can order me off the street. I hate to belong to an organization that is proud of being a caste of superior beings, that is proud of killing free ideas so that it may more effectively kill human beings." This is not the currently popular attitude toward members of the armed forces. It is, however, an historically accurate one. The very troops we are exhorted to love and cherish can be turned against us, ordered to suppress dissent and round up political activists. The chilling thought is that in times like these, such repressive acts could have popular support, at least initially, as happened during the Vietnam War, with the use of police and National Guards to quell protest. National security is boilerplated over the Constitution. Vietnam taught us that a war cannot perpetually continue without public support. That can be a provocation for rallying around a flag and tying it with a yellow ribbon. It is a better argument for refusing to endorse a war so that it might quickly end or perhaps never begin. The war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent against their wars as sedition and disloyalty. But dissent is necessary. It is the true act of patriotism and a more reasonable way to support the troops than thrusting them upon other armies. There is no good war and no bad peace, Benjamin Franklin said. But peace is also defined as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce more and newer weapons, sow newer crops of human fodder to continue the genocides of their fathers. It is difficult to separate peace from its evil twin, war, not unlike concentrating on yang without including yin. Peace and war are joined at the hip, human perceptions that have few parallels in nature. The rapacious wars of ants are analogous. Somehow, we co-inventors of war think we can have life without it, which we baptize as peace. The questions of how to end warfare are ancient, but never as popular as promoting it. The very few who raise the issue of abolishing war have through the centuries been imprisoned, exiled, or executed. At the very least, they have been ostracized. Pacifism exudes an odor of weakness and appeasement, and pacifists are accused of being agents of an enemy or are dismissed as dupes. Pacifists are themselves in conflict. The central, most agonizing question is whether some principles are worth the risk of annihilation. Human life and possibly all organic existence is conceivably so rare in the universe that its loss as a result of conflict over abstract principles peculiar to a point in time would be more intolerable than the loss of those principles, which, human in origin, would just as surely be evaporated in a Holocaust. What difference does it make to the dead, Gandhi said, whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy name of liberty or democracy? Solutions to warfare have been ambiguous, insipid, and often ridiculous. Most pacifists agree that the only end to warfare will be a world state of some form. But one-world theories range from a loose federation of states not unlike the United Nations, with the exception that its laws would be binding, to naked utopias and other worldly Edens, or more ominously, Orwellian or Huxleyan nightmares of rigid authority and mind control, as well as perpetual war. Most solutions acknowledge the necessity of alternatives to warfare to engage its immense energies. William James suggested in 1914, the year World War I began, that there should be a moral equivalent to warfare, and that's a quote. And though his idea that society exhibit the pomp and circumstance of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta was rather silly, but not out of context with his pompous era, he also thought that so long as the anti-militarists propose no substitute, no moral equivalent to war, the duties, penalties, and sanctions pictured in the utopias they paint are all too weak and tame to touch the military-minded. That is precisely the point. Militarism rules the planet. Military values are taught at every level of education and are incorporated in the root systems of societal values. Militarism is the antithesis of liberty and democracy, and its justice is based on obedience and servitude. The economies of most nations are poured into war machines that posture as defensive instruments, and world leaders blackmail their populations with terror, force them to surrender their lives and their children's futures, their wealth and liberties, if they possess either, to the gross appetites and deadly illusions of military power. Nightmares of doom are disguised as dream worlds of prosperity. Armageddon is the place for the last battle at the end of the world. Almost all religions and myths prophesize a final conflict or cataclysm that will terminate human life, and our history has propelled us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. Military castes have been as irresponsible as priests in exhorting doom. They speak of themselves as guardians of peace, but prepare the methods of the final combat, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. War is to a man what childbirth is to a woman, Benito Mussolini was fond of saying. Putting an end to warfare will not end human conflict or greed, but war should be put aside as a toy of our youth. The ancient assumption that war weeds out the weak, unfit, and unlucky to ensure strength in future generations has been disproved by the enormous and indiscriminately devastating wars of the 20th century. A general who commanded the largest armies in history and who, as President of the United States, warned the world of the sinister and possibly obliterative consequences of the military-industrial mafia, for political reasons he left out the third leg of the triad, Congress. Dwight David Eisenhower once said, "People want peace so much that one of these days government had better get out of the way and let them have it." The United States commemorates its war dead on Memorial Day, which is at the end of May. It would be the proper occasion to pierce the illusions and deceptions and remember that the hallowed dead would bitterly protest being used to kill others and to take note of something written by Boris Vann. The day when nobody comes back from a war, it will be because war has at last been properly organized. "With them in hell," wrote Wilfred Owen, regarded the best poet of World War I and perhaps the best war poet ever, killed a week before armistice. "With them in hell, the sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell." And that is something I wrote for Memorial Day, recruiting tomorrow's dead. This has been Michael McCusker. And I guess I will be back next Thursday if the triad does not occur to me, a truck run me down, the sky fall, or I plunge into the river for one reason or another.